This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. The Trump administration has fired nearly 60 cruise missiles at a Syrian airbase. The action was in response to the chemical weapons attack the Assad regime is strongly suspected of carrying out against civilians earlier this week. President Trump announced the action from his estate in West Palm Beach, Florida, Mar-a-Lago.
Bashar al-Assad launched a horrible chemical weapons attack on innocent civilians. Using a deadly nerve agent, Assad choked out the lives of helpless men, women, and children. It was a slow and brutal death for so many. Even beautiful babies were cruelly murdered in this very barbaric attack. No child of God should ever suffer such horror.
We will talk about the response, and we will welcome your thoughts and questions. Do you think this was the appropriate action or not? What are your hopes and fears now with the U.S. and Syria? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We'll spend considerable time on this story during the week in review, but not entirely. We will talk about other top issues in state and national politics later on in the program. Let me welcome our guest. Very happy to have with us Steve Prestigard, a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Christine Bremer-Moogley, an attorney with Bremer and Trollope Law Offices in Wausau. She was a member of the Electoral College in 2008 and 2012. Good morning.
Hi, Joy. Hi, Steve. Good morning.
Well, let's get your reactions, Steve, first, to the U.S. launching 59 cruise missiles at the Syrian airbase that housed the warplanes that carried out this week's chemical weapons attack in that country. Those chemical weapons attacks killed at least 70 people. Your reaction to the U.S. Firing some missiles over there?
Well, it was... I think it was a measured response. It was, frankly, an overdue response, and I understand that this is a response to the horrific chemical weapons attack. If you've not seen photos and I even saw some video of the aftermath of the attack, it's just, it's horrific is the only word that comes to mind. It is also... I don't think it's an overreaction, and fortunately, I don't think it's an underreaction either. You know, all the people who have been kind of criticizing Trump, sometimes including myself, for kind of acting like a clown, frankly, over the campaign and during the first couple of months of his presidency, he acted absolutely presidential, and I think that this is also one of those things that wasn't necessarily only targeted to Syria. You know, he's meeting with the Chinese premier, Mar-a-Lago, and I have to believe that that was a message that was intended also to be sent to North Korea's whack job leader. And I think that it ought to demonstrate to a lot of countries, including the various bad actors out there, that how this country is going to deal with gross violations of human rights and human dignity, like chemical weapons attacks, is going to be a whole lot different than how they've been dealt with the last 8 years.
Christine, your response to the U.S. response.
Well, interesting comments, Steve. I agree with a lot of what you said. I believe this was a limited response. He could have done a lot more. But, you know, from my perspective, when we all watch those horrific films of those children and all of the people that were suffering horribly under the gas attack, you wonder about why we have cut off in Trump's budget humanitarian aid to refugees and why we don't let Syrians come into our country. You know, we've let 841 Syrians into our country as refugees. Canada has let 25,000 in. So it's wonderful to now stand up for the people that are being so brutally treated by their own leader. But I think that the United States has to be more consistent with its response. You know, why do we have a travel ban and why are we cutting humanitarian aid when Trump is so very, you know, the way he spoke about the children and the babies, you could hear the emotion in his voice. But let's see where else he's going to go with this. You know, we can't have an erratic foreign policy. You can't have a policy that, you know, on Monday you say we're not going to do anything and we're going to actually help Assad rebuild the country and you know, have a conference in Brussels scheduled to talk about funding rebuilding Syria. And then on Thursday, we're bombing them. So, you know, I agree that this is giving a message to the world, but what is the message? It's kind of a message of an erratic foreign policy. He attacked Obama for not taking the steps that he took in 2013 when Obama wouldn't cross the red line and Putin agreed to help get all of the chemical weapons out of Syria. And Obama decided not to bomb because the Senate also wouldn't give him a vote to authorize it. You know, he was very much criticized for that recently by President Trump. So, you know, it's very difficult to know where he stands. He's emotional. He's erratic. I don't criticize, you know, the 59 Tomahawk missiles going in after what they did. But let's look at the full policy and let's have a plan that makes some sense.
Well, Russian President Vladimir Putin, a close ally of Assad in Syria, also condemned the U.S. strike. He called it an aggression against a sovereign state in violation of international law, among other things. Christine, your thoughts on the Russian response and you know, what this means with Russia?
Well, you know, there were Russians there at that airbase, so they must have known, because at that airbase, they have chemical stockpiles. So the Russians must have known about this. We have tracking of the Syrian plane going right over the city where they dropped the bombs. So there is no doubt that this happened. And saying that this is an aggressive act against Syria is absolutely wrong. We were making an aggressive act against someone who was committing a war crime. You know, Putin won't depose Assad because it helps him. It's his only base outside of out of Russia where he can really put military. So he needs that base, and he's going to support him. You know, we cannot listen to Putin on this, and I hope this puts some real space between Putin and Trump in a meaningful way so that we can see what Trump for the first time sees what Putin is really about. You know, there's a risk here. Putin won't do anything to Assad. Obviously, that's a big risk for Trump. There's also a big risk that ISIS fills a vacuum if Assad gets weakened. You know, that's how it happens there. A vacuum creates power. And it doesn't seem that there's any real plan for diplomatic action here on our on this administration. So there's some real risks here. Let's hope that with his new, stronger team in place, having more or less deposed Bannon out of the National Security Council, maybe there's going to be some real strong effort by our Secretary of Defense and McMaster to take over this and help develop a foreign policy that really means something.
Steve?
Yeah, I agree with most of what Christine just said. There is a danger, and you know, this is unfortunately it's an American thing, or at least it has been for the past actually, to be honest, 15 years or so. You know, well, we got to get rid of this guy. Okay, what are we going to replace him with, or what is he going to be replaced with? And I don't think that that has always been well thought out, and you end up with unintended consequences. Remember all those Arab Spring moments back a few years ago, and they ended up all being, you know, in, I think of Egypt, for instance, where Mubarak was replaced with people who were arguably worse, at least for some amount of time. I think this is Putin's problem. You know, Assad is his guy, and that is, you know, hardly surprised to hear the kind of statement that Putin made. I also don't think it means a single thing. I think, however, we have to be careful what happens after that, because as we've seen in the Middle East in certain spots, it is possible to replace a bad person. Libya comes immediately to mind, in charge with somebody or some group who ends up worse. Christine made a mention about refugees in a previous response, but you know, that's really a separate problem. I think what Trump wants, what Trump is intending to do, is to keep the problem, keep the problem in Syria and not bring it here by letting a bunch of Syrian refugees who this government doesn't seem very capable of vetting to make sure that they're in fact not threats to this country in terrorism or some others in some other sense. I think also people ought to be pretty pleased, frankly, that in contrast to what the impression was given before, that Trump is actually listening to the correct people in his administration, Secretary Mattis being one example of that. And in kind of a, you know, the weird thing that happened earlier this week with Steve Bannon suddenly being punted from the National Security Council, I think it's good to see that Trump is listening to the right people, and at least based on that, not listening to the wrong people in his administration anymore.
We're going to take a short pause, and then we're going to take a bunch of calls from many listeners who want to weigh in on this issue, and we'll also talk about other stories in the news this week during the Week in Review, talking with two guests from different perspectives, Steve Prestigard and Christine Bremer-Moogley. Our number is 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network. This is the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Steve Prestigard and Christine Bremer-Moogley today, and with you. If you'd like to weigh in on this military strike on a Syrian government airbase, which was done in response to the chemical weapons attack that killed dozens of civilians earlier in the week. Do you think that this was the appropriate move or not? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Tammy in Elroy is with us. Hi, Tammy.
Hi. Assad is clearly an evil dictator. Of that, there is no doubt. However, it's only suspected that he used a chemical attack. And if that comes out to be true, then that is clearly a war crime, which we can hold him accountable for. I don't believe that dropping 60 bombs on the Syrian people and their country is going to do anything to help investigate it, to do any kind of rash action. It is, there's no plan. We don't know what happens after this. There's no course of action now. We get to wait until see what, how they react. This is very well going to put us into another war with no direction.
All right, we get to Tammy. I'm sorry. First off, Tammy says there's no real evidence that Assad ordered the chemical weapons attacks, and indeed the Syrian government is denying that it was responsible. Steve, do you think there is any evidence there, or could this have been the rebels that did this?
I've seen that theory online. It's kind of amazing, frankly, the number of people on the far left and the far right who seem to believe that the rebels would, you know, do something like that. But I'm not sure that they're sophisticated enough to think that that's really a good idea. The attack, by the way, if I understand correctly, was on the Syrian military. It was not. It wasn't as if they went and bombed the same people that they that just got gassed in the chemical weapons attack. I think you don't necessarily need to have every last detail as far as what you want to do for this to have a deterrent effect on Assad. And Assad has been in a several-year-old civil war against his own people. I don't know that there are credible sources to, you know, suggest that the Syrian rebels did this, you know, kind of set this off or something like that. I don't find those kinds of things credible. Yeah, there hasn't been an investigation, but, you know, the other thing is you need, in a situation like this, I think, you need to have a response, and you can't let it wait for 6 months while you, you know, sit there and dot I's and cross T's. So I understand that there are people who believe that. I'm not buying it.
Well, Christine? I guess I'd like to say that there appears to be, although I agree with Tammy, I'm certainly not someone that's supporting war, especially with no plan. But this is more than suspected. We have film, and they have tracking of Syrian planes taking off from the airbase and going right over the city where they dropped the bombs, the chemical canisters, and they have witnesses in the town that saw the smoke coming from where the bombs were dropped at the same hour in the morning, 7 a.m. So I don't think there's any doubt that they did it. They can claim that they didn't, or that the ISIS was in there and they had gotten hold of these sarin gas canisters, but that's just not going to be proven true. I think that we know that Assad has done this in the past, and he has a motive for doing it, which is to terrify the people. He wishes to terrify his people and demoralize them. They drive these people into this province. They push them there by starving them and bombing them, giving them some hope of peace. And then they go in and say, well, there's some terrorists in the area. 3 million people live in that province. So they have some terrorists in the area, a few, and they bomb the whole place. They're bombing hospitals. They're bombing all of the places where the children and the civilians are. For what reason? The only reason is to demoralize them. So there's a motive behind this. And Trump is right, I believe, to send a strong message. But if the message isn't backed up with a plan, we lose all the motive of it. It's an erratic plan, and he has to become more disciplined in order for this to work.
John in Madison is next. Hi, John.
Well, al-Nusra has usurped in the past, and we need to dot every I and cross every T before we launch missiles against somebody. This could have been al-Nusra's stored chemical gas that was ignited by the bombs. We don't know the precise projectiles that carried it. They do have a chemical signature. This required an investigation before anything was done. This is precipitous. This is an act of war by our country against a sovereign country. The only time we are legally allowed to do this under the UN Charter, which is the law of our land, is if we are attacked directly or there's imminent attack. This didn't satisfy either one. We are technically at war with Assad now. This, to me, is a travesty. And the hypocrisy of this, in view of all the citizens that have been killed by Trump's escalation of the war in Yemen, Somalia, Syria, and Iraq, is just incredible. We have killed far more civilians, including kids, than this chemical attack did, and very little has been said about that.
Thank you, John. I'm going to go right away to Brad in Jefferson. Hi, Brad.
Good morning. I'm a veteran of the Gulf War, and I question the legality of the attack on Syria. Under international law, you can only attack another nation in self-defense when an attack is going on.
Yeah, and that's what John was saying. So, Christine, what can you say about, you're a lawyer, no, is it even legal for the U.S. to perform a military strike like this?
The president is supposed to get authorization from the Congress, which he did not get, and that's what President Obama did not get in 2013 when he backed off the red line that everyone talks about. But when a president believes the national interests of the country are at risk, as Donald Trump stated in his comments last night, he has authority to go forward. There is obviously arguments that he did not have authority, and I think our caller is right to question that, but Presidents do take these actions when they believe the national security of our country is at risk. It's my understanding that there was some consultation with members of Congress, but they certainly did not get authority to do so. So if you look under the War Powers Act, they are supposed to get this authorization. He did not get it, but there is an issue, as Donald Trump raised it last night, of the national security of our country being at risk, and that's why he did it.
Yeah. Steve, do you think the national security of our country was at risk?
I believe it probably was in the, not necessarily with Syria exactly, but obviously the U.S. does have a long-term strategic interest in the Middle East. You may decry that, but that happens to be a fact. And presidents going as far back as Harry Truman have concluded that we do, in fact, have a strategic interest in the Middle East. If you want to avoid Syria exporting its civil war into other countries in the Middle East, or this country, frankly, you have to do something about this. And I understand it's pretty obvious that we're not quite sure what the next step of this is going to be, but I think this is an action that probably would have been done by a whole lot of other presidents besides Trump in this case.
Gary on Facebook writes, it looks like the air base that launched the chemical attacks was successfully destroyed and that Russia and China were informed of it beforehand. If you don't like seeing babies killed by sarin gas, this is what needs to be done. And regardless of the political theater rhetoric, Russia understands this also. Well, Steve, you can respond to Gary's comment, but also, was this just a one-time and done thing, or what do you think?
Well, it depends on what Assad does next, frankly, as far as Syria goes. But, you know, I think I said this at the beginning. I don't think this was intended only at Syria. I think it was absolutely intended at North Korea as well. I don't think it was an accident necessarily. It was a timing thing, obviously, but I think that there was probably a conversation that took place last night between Trump and the Chinese premier, who happens conveniently to be in this country right now, as to how something like that against the Syrians could certainly be done to the North Koreans if China didn't make Kim Jong-un behave. And so, you know, this was not necessarily something only pointed at Syria. And I think it was also intended as a message to other bad actors out there that how the U.S. responds to things now isn't the way that the U.S. might have responded to things in a previous administration.
What do you think of that, Christine?
Well, Joy, I think that we have to keep in mind that when President Obama launched attacks in 2014, 2015, he did it under the authorization that President Bush received after the attacks in 2000, you know, on September 11th. And there was an authorization from Congress to fight terrorists. If you take that tack and say all of this stems back to that time, there is possibly an argument that there's authorization. It's a stretch. But, you know, when we've got a president who's saying we are going to fight anyone that uses chemical weapons, that goes beyond just Syria. And I think it does go to any other dictator who wants to become empowered and use horrible weapons of mass destruction. And that's what the president said. There's an argument that he has some authority if he notifies Congress, as we talked about before. But, you know, this is something that is new ground for us. So we have to see where it's going. The Congress doesn't seem ready to authorize war, but the president is going to take some steps. We have a president who declares that he's going to take action. So we have to get used to this, and I think we're all going to have to be vigilant in making certain, especially those in Congress, that he acts with authority and at least within 48 hours of a strike notifies Congress as he's required to do.
Yeah, on Wednesday, before the strike, President Trump told reporters that part of the reason that the chemical attack in Syria happened in the first place was because of a lack of action by President Obama. Let's take a listen.
the Obama administration had a great opportunity to solve this crisis a long time ago when he said the red line in the sand. And when he didn't cross that line after making the threat, I think that set us back a long ways, not only in Syria, but in many other parts of the world, because it was a blank threat. I think it was something that was not one of our better days as a country.
So what do you think of that, Christine?
Well, I think that making blank threats is not smart, and I agree that it should not have been made. But keep in mind that what President Obama was trying to do at that time was to find some other solution, because none of us are in favor of war, and especially we know President Obama was absolutely against it, and he felt the feelings of the people of our nation, that we did not want to go to war in Syria. So what happened then, if you all remember, was that there was an agreement with Putin to get all, as we said before today, get all the chemical weapons out, and Assad just did not do it, obviously, because he used the weapons. So I think that Did President Obama have an opportunity to strike then? Yes. Would it have made much difference today? Probably not, because you cannot destroy the nation. What was he going to strike? It's the same as this. It's a limited strike. It's to give a message. We're not going to put up with this. He did get a diplomatic solution. He did not get the votes. He tried to get the votes from the Senate Armed Services Committee. They would not give it to him. So when he tried to get authorization, when Obama tried to get authorization from the Congress, he could not get it. So he got a diplomatic solution, which hopefully he was proud of, thinking that we were going to get rid of these chemical weapons at the time. But it just didn't work out that well. So it's easy to look back and say, well, you should have done this or you should have done that. But keep in mind that at the time, Trump said that Obama should not strike. The problem that he has with it now is that he made this threat. So was the threat right? Probably not. But remember that Trump's own position then was that Obama should not strike.
Frank in Green Bay, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a different kind of approach on this. I never heard the word fake news until last number of months, and I've never heard it so much. Now, when it comes to proving something or disproving something, you can have aerial photography, as we may have. I'm sure we do, with this plane taking off and plane dropping things and identifying what type of plane it was. And maybe we may not yet know what type of gas it was, but we can have some proof. The Russians and the Syrians can say, well, that's fake news. Just as we have thrown around different understandings of what is now truth and what is now fake. And I think that that's going to come to bite us in the future when we come to not only domestic issues but world issues. People will just say, well, that's fake. And we've heard the President of the United States say that over and over again. And then Putin himself and those who surround him use those same words, and I think that's problematic now when we try to gather world opinion in favor of something.
All right, so I'm not sure Frank thinks it was fake, but is the whole fake news thing, Steve, playing into this?
Well, for one thing, I'm pretty sure that there are not many people who believe what Putin said, that, you know, claiming that the attack was fake, Syrians claiming that the attack was actually staged by the rebels. That's a statement that doesn't have any credibility at all. I would say that that a little skepticism about what governments say isn't a bad thing. We should have had a whole lot more skepticism in this country before now, frankly, about what government says, instead of simply accepting everything on face value. Is it a problem in instances like that? In instances like this, yeah, it is potentially a problem. But I don't see an effort at this point to gather up a worldwide alliance. Like, and just pulling an example out, you know, going back to Desert Storm in 1991, where there was a worldwide effort to make Saddam Hussein leave Kuwait. I don't see that that's happening at all. So, you know, as I said, skepticism about what government says is an overdue thing. And I suppose it's kind of like the, you know, statements I've seen before where dissent is now patriotic. Now that a Republican as president. And now there's skepticism coming from a certain direction on the political spectrum over what governments say that there wasn't before the presidential administration change.
I'm going to take one last call on this, and we have to move to a few other issues, as this is the whole week in review. Doug in Portage, go ahead.
Hi, I just had a very scary, odd question to ask. Last night when I was looking at the news, about an hour before I saw the Syrian strike posted, there was something more about Russian involvement. Could it be a very scary situation where this was something that Trump did to cover other news?
Christine, was this a wag the dog thing?
Oh, Doug. Well, who knows, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're not living in normal times. I can't imagine under any set of circumstances that this would be the case. But, you know, we never imagined that a presidential candidate would encourage Russians to hack our elections either. So I think that I hope that what you're saying is not true. But, you know, just as our previous caller said, you know, we're all going down these lines of what's real and what's not. There's so much out there that we can dream up. I think we have to try to stay focused on reality and hope that, in fact, the people around Trump, and we have to think our Secretary of Defense and our NSA advisors are honest people, and they would not say that they did not have tracking of Syrian planes dropping chemical weapons at the time when all the people became affected by this horrible problem. And I can't imagine that Trump had anything to do with affecting Syrians to drop chemical weapons on their own people.
All right, Steve, a brief react to that.
Christine's right. In order to believe that Trump did this to cover up something else, you'd have to believe that Trump managed to get the Syrian military to attack, you know, to do the chemical warfare attack in the first place. I think that strains credulity to think that that's the case.
Yeah.
Well, let's just do a quick hit on a number of different stories that we should cover in the week in review. Since our caller brought up Russia, let's talk about House Intelligence Committee Chair Devin Nunes announced that he will recuse himself from the panel's investigation into the Russian meddling in the presidential election. He said several left-wing groups have filed accusations against him with the Office of Congressional Ethics, and he wants to get all of that cleaned up before resuming his duties on the probe. Speaker Paul Ryan applauded Nunes's decision.
It is clear that this process would be a distraction to the House Intelligence Committee's investigation into Russian interference in our election. So Chairman Nunes has offered to step aside as the lead Republican on this particular probe, and I fully support his decision.
So was that the right thing to do, Steve?
Yeah, because it removes the distraction. It removes a a reason for people to claim, although I'm sure they will anyway, just because that's the kind of times we live in, it removes a reason to question the legitimacy of the investigation. So whether or not it really needed to happen, it's probably politically a good thing.
President Trump on Wednesday told the New York Times that former National Security Advisor Susan Rice may have committed a crime by seeking to learn the names of Trump associates who were swept up in surveillance of foreign officials by U.S. intelligence agencies. Conservative media figures accused Rice of not only unmasking the identities but leaking them to the media. The Times noted that Americans' identities can be revealed for national security reasons, and that it actually probably happens more than you might think. Rice called Trump's allegations absolutely false. Christine, your reaction to this?
Well, I think that they love to pick on Susan Rice for some reason. She's a very strong woman and does not hold her cards too close to her vest. She lets it known what she feels. This is the woman who was the national security advisor to our president. Keep in mind that we now know from CIA, former CIA Director Brennan, that last summer in August and in September, they were aware that there were advisors to Trump who might be working with Russians to interfere with the election in some way. That's what the CIA unmasked. That's what they reported to the group, Gang of Eight. So now you're the national security advisor, and you see this report, and it comes through saying that an American without a name is identified as being involved in this. Are you going to unmask that name or not? I mean, it's ridiculous to think that she would not. And that's her job. So, you know, to try to criticize her for doing her job as the national security advisor when our election is coming under threat by report of our own CIA, such report that had so much credence that they actually went to the Gang of Eight, the leaders of the Congress, to tell them that, is that not her job? So I think this is another, you know, I would go along with Doug on this one, our former caller, about we have to look what's real here. What Trump is doing here by going after Susan Rice, one of their favorite targets, is to criticize her for doing her job. You know, if we go back to Nunes, we've got a guy who is under investigation by the House Committee on Ethics. It's on the House Committee, because of public outcry, is investigating him, not the Office of Congressional Ethics. But the House Committee is investigating him because he disclosed to the president information that was classified in the course of an investigation of the president's own campaign. So we've got two totally different things going on here. We've got a guy who's supposed to hold secrets, and he goes right to the person under investigation and tells them those secrets. And then you've got Susan Rice, who is our national security advisor, who gets a report about interference of our elections by the Russians, and she tries to find out who it is, and we're criticizing her, and there's no evidence that she leaked anything. So, you know, it's just another one of those situations where please keep your eye on the ball here and don't let these distractions concerning this investigation take away from the very important question is, did the Russians interfere with our election? And if so, were they aided by any American citizens?
Yeah. And, Steve, briefly on Susan Rice was just doing her job, Christine says.
You know, there was a phrase I read on the is from one of the Washington Post bloggers yesterday about Susan Rice, and the exact phrase was a strained relationship with the truth. Remember Benghazi? So there's that. There's also quite a huge amount of evidence that Susan Rice, over her time in the Obama administration, let partisan interests get over national security interests. And the other thing, of course, that I find amusing about all this is that we are supposed to believe that Russians were able to compel people to vote for Donald Trump and Republicans instead of Hillary Clinton and Democrats. And, you know, regardless of whether they threw propaganda at us or you know, whatever the Russians allegedly, supposedly did during the election, the idea that Russians made people vote for Trump instead of Hillary Clinton is just really amusing to me, at any rate.
But, well, I'm going to have to take our break because we're way past break time, and then we will talk a little bit about Supreme Court nominee Gorsuch and the nuclear option being pulled yesterday. And state news, state budget hearings happening, and Tony Evers winning the DPI race. And I hope we can fit that in after we take this break. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Christine Bremer-Moogley and Steve Prestigard during this edition of The Week in Review. Welcoming your comments on other issues at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. The Senate is expected to confirm Neil Gorsuch today as the next U.S. Supreme Court Justice. Shortly after Democrats filibustered him, Senate Republicans employed the so-called nuclear option to require only majority approval instead of the 60-vote requirement. Here is Minority Leader Chuck Schumer defending his party's position on this.
We believe that what Republicans did to Merrick Garland was worse than a filibuster, declaring mere hours after Justice Scalia's death, that they would deny the constitutional prerogative of a president with 11 months left in his term. And as my colleague from Illinois noted, we did not hear two words in the long speech of Senator McConnell, Merrick Garland.
Republican Senator Orrin Hatch was asked on CNN whether his party is being hypocritical by calling out the Democrats for trying to block Gorsuch after the GOP refused to advance Merrick Garland last year. And here is how Hatch responded.
I'll just tell you straight up, that's total BS of what you're saying there, because there, I can't go back in time and show you any case where during a presidential election year they've allowed a Supreme Court justice be nominated unless both sides agreed, and both sides didn't agree on this.
So, Christine, first, what's your reaction to what's happened in the Senate over the Gorsuch confirmation?
Well, it's sad, but it was, I guess, inevitable. Orrin Hatch, he's a piece of work, in my opinion. There is no precedent whatsoever for not allowing a president in the fourth year of his term of office from nominating a member to the Supreme Court. There's nothing. There's no law that supports that. It's total hypocrisy. And, you know, when in 2013, when Harry Reid, as leader of the Senate, took away executed the nuclear option with regard to the all other nominees for federal executive branch appointments and for federal judges, you know, they said, the Republicans said that the Democrats were trampling the rights of the minority in violation of the founders' protections that had been put in place to keep the Senate a bipartisan chamber. So now here we are. We've got a situation where at that time, the reason that Harry Reid did that was because the Republicans were refusing to put forward any of the federal judges that Obama was nominating. Their goal was to prevent him from seating 50 vacancies into the federal judiciary, and they had to stop it. There were also, at that time, 59 nominees just for positions into the executive branch that Republicans did not want to be filled by Obama. So, that's what happened then, and so now we've got this payback. And so it's a sad day for our country. We always think of the Senate as being the place where there can be a deliberative process and bipartisanship. I guess those days are over.
Mm-hmm. Steve?
Those days have been over for a long time, Christine. But, I find it interesting that you mentioned, that, Democrats are on the great side on this and all of this. And you forget, for instance, back in 1992, when a guy named Joe Biden, who was in the Senate, said that President Bush, the first President Bush, said that we shouldn't have any nominee for the Supreme Court, given the fact that President Bush was in his fourth year and turned out to be his last year in office. But you can certainly go back farther, back to 1987, as a matter of fact, when we got a new verb in the English language, to bork, when Democrats engineered the seat of Robert Bork for the Supreme Court. And everything that has gone around with the Supreme Court since then is a direct result of that, going back 30 years. Also, by the way, where does the word filibuster appear in the U.S. Constitution? It doesn't. The filibuster is, and cloture rules and all of that, are part of the rules of the Senate. And the Senate can make its own rules, and the Senate can change its own rules. I will certainly attest that we don't really know what the result of this is going to be, and it's possible that Republicans at some future point will regret having done this. I kind of wonder how Democrats feel having having the Reid rule thrown right back in their face with this. But you know what? Elections have consequences, and the majority of Americans, or majority of voters in enough states, voted for Republicans to take over the Senate.
Mark in Green Bay joins us. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I'll be quick, but I was just, this whole thing with the judicial election, it was basically inevitable, and he had plenty of warning that the nuclear option was going to happen if everybody acted up. And I'm very disappointed in Tammy Baldwin for not basically just voting for Gorsuch and trying to get to some compromise level and try to be reasonable about this whole thing. Instead, the Democratic Party is starting to look like a bunch of middle school teenage girls on a rampage about Trump.
All right. Well, let's...
Okay, come on. We don't need sexist comments.
Yeah, we don't need that. But Christine...
You know, so I guess I would say, Mark, I think that we should look at Tammy Baldwin's real principled stance on this. The Democrats stood together because of the way President Obama was denied his opportunity and his right to nominate a person to the Supreme Court. They did not even give Merrick Garland a hearing or a vote, and she stood on that principled ground. Moreover, I think that there were certainly grounds for anyone who is on the side of the Constitution being a living document to say that Judge Gorsuch had some real issues with regard to his past decisions, with regard to women's rights, with regard to workers' rights, with regard to religious freedom. So there were reasons to vote against him, not only because of the fact that President Obama was denied Merrick Garland, but also because of his record.
I have to move on to another story. In state news, Tony Evers won a third term as the Wisconsin State Superintendent of Public Instruction this week, beating challenger Lowell Holtz 70-30%. He won in 70 of the state's 72 counties. So, Steve, why such a lopsided victory for Tony Evers?
Well, you knew that was going to happen because that he basically got that. He had an overwhelming margin, at any rate, in the primary when he was facing two challengers. I will admit that I don't necessarily understand why conservatives have not really seriously, and I mean with enough money to make it a race, challenged the superintendent position, unless they truly believe that the superintendent really doesn't have as much authority as others might like to think. I mean, you know, we talked about the state budget, or got brought up. How much is Tony Evers influencing the state budget deliberations right now? And the answer is, I don't believe at all. So that may be the answer, but I certainly would have preferred a more vigorous and a more financially strong challenge to what is a position that is basically a slave of the teachers' unions in this state.
I only have a minute. So, Christine, your reaction to Tony Evers' victory?
Tony, well, I totally disagree. 70% of the vote shows the people of Wisconsin support Tony Evers. He is influencing the budget. The governor actually adopted most of what Tony Evers asked for. Governor put in $649 million. Tony Evers asked for $700 million in spending for the schools. The people of Wisconsin have said, do not abandon Common Core. Do not expand vouchers. They support a man who supports our teachers. We don't want massive cuts to our before and after school programs. We don't want cuts to teachers' training. People of Wisconsin have said they want to support our referendums and are even willing to take tax increases to do so because the state is not doing its job to support our schools. So I'm real proud of the people of Wisconsin for supporting Tony Evers. He's a great guy and a very wonderful superintendent.
I did want to talk more about the state budget, but we have less than 30 seconds, so I'm afraid we can't get to it. I want to thank you both very, very much for being with us. Christine Bremer-Moogley, an attorney with Bremer and Trollope Law Offices in Wausau, and Steve Prestigard, a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. Thanks to both of them for being with us during this edition of The Week in Review. We will continue talking state budget issues over the next couple of weeks as the Joint Finance Committee goes on its road tour. Thanks to Bill Martins for producing this program. I'm Joy Curtin. This is the Ideas Network.